The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Northeast Credit Union,
helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of
auto, home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you
to discover the difference at
necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system,
improving the health of our communities for years to come.
Information at
imagine.d-h.org.
Word of mouth.
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 Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Hillary Clinton's name will be a familiar one on the primary ballot this spring. What many voters won't know is the complicated story behind how that name evolved. Hillary Clinton is the third official name she's used since marrying Bill Clinton in 1975. And David Graham, staff writer for The Atlantic, who covers global news and U.S. politics, is with us to explain what her changing names say about women in American politics. David, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having me.
So Hillary Rodham Clinton kept her name after marrying Bill Clinton. Was that common back in 1975?
It was getting more common, although it was still fairly uncommon. It was particularly uncommon in Arkansas, where she moved to be with him. And it was a fairly controversial decision, both in his family and with Arkansas voters.
Really? Did they complain?
Well, so when they got married, Bill told his mother that she would be keeping her name, and she reported in her memoir that she cried about it. Bill seemed to be fine with it, but his mother was not. And then later, when Bill ran for governor, it was a controversial thing. A lot of the profiles of him in the national media and locally really talked about the fact that she kept her maiden name. The campaign went out of its way to insist that she was in some ways very old-fashioned and concerned about family, despite this radical women's lib step of keeping her maiden name.
So when did she change it to Hillary Rodham Clinton?
Well, actually, after Bill Clinton lost his re-election bid in 1980, he decided to run again in 1982 to get back the governorship. And in that race, she told him that she wanted to start using Hillary Rodham Clinton as her name. He objected. He thought she was sort of giving up some of her important identity. And she said, "I don't want this to be the reason you lose this election." And so from then on, for many years, she went by Hillary Rodham Clinton.
Yeah, it really sort of exposes a couple things here. There's the repackaging of the self that male politicians really don't have to think about. But also that supports this idea of Hillary as a person making political calculations, you know, doing whatever it takes to appeal to a larger public. Do you think that's fair?
I don't know if it's fair. I think it's definitely an interpretation that's been out there. I mean, I think your point about male politicians is exactly right. This is a question no male politician is ever asked to deal with. In some profiles in the 90s, it was said that this moment when she decided to take on Bill's name was really her birth as a politician, when she went from being an idealist and a policy wonk to being somebody immersed in the world of politics, where you sometimes have to posture a little bit.
Well, we do remember in 1992 when Bill Clinton was running for president, the comment that was seized upon by Hillary Clinton saying, "You know, I suppose I could have stayed home and baked cookies, but instead devoted myself to my own profession." So a name change like this signifies much more than a name.
That's right, absolutely. I think in many cases, what she's doing with the name is really only reflecting the deeper currents that are going on in various electorates rather than anything particularly about her.
The New York Times recently announced it would officially begin referring to her as Hillary Clinton, as opposed to Hillary Rodham Clinton, as had been the Times convention. So where did that change come from? Is that something the Clinton campaign wants out there?
It is. It's something that's been sort of a long time coming. The campaign has been referring to her simply as Hillary Clinton. If you look at her website or you look at her logos, that's the way she's referred to. When she's filed for ballots, she said she's Hillary Clinton. And in fact, the change at the Times and as well at the Associated Press and I believe the Washington Post is due to a request from the campaign or from the campaign saying that's how they preferred her to be referred to. What's interesting, though, is in many cases, the last name is no longer relevant. Hmm. She's Hillary. It's a single name thing. People know who she is. And that's been the case really since 2000 when she first ran for Senate in New York. All of her branding just said Hillary for Senate.
Well, as you point out in your article, you know, saying maiden name is in itself a sexist term.
That's right. It's very deeply embedded, the way we talk about these things.
Yeah, that, you know, you are made until you are a wife, a big assumption. But using that given name, I'll use that term, is once again on the rise in the U.S. after a period of women taking on the names of their husbands for, I guess, the last 15 years. So does this show a kind of generational gap between Hillary and younger Americans?
That's an interesting question. I mean, in some ways, she was ahead of her time. And in other ways, you do see that in the fact that she decided to go ahead and take on her husband's name, it does create a gap. What I'm interested to see is, as more and more women enter politics, and you know the numbers still lag behind society in general, but they are rising, how many younger female politicians keep their maiden name or their given name, and how many of them decide to take on their husband's name? And I think that will be an interesting symbol about where women are in American politics and you know what voters are willing to accept and how old-fashioned they are.
Well, David Graham, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you.
David Graham covers global news and U.S. politics for The Atlantic. You'll find a link to read his article, Hillary Rodham Clinton's Changing Names. The link is at wordofmouthradio.org. Well, as we've just heard, a name carries symbolic power. Think Madonna, Adele, Oprah, and yes, Hillary. This next story is about a name that marks the streets of San Francisco and about one man's obsessive hunt for the person it belongs to. And it comes to us from Roman Mars from 99% Invisible.
How to make a concrete stylus. Take a large nail, heat the tip red hot in a blue gas flame, drop it in ice water. Now it will resist abrasion as it cuts through the sand, cement, and rock particles in concrete not yet hardened. From the abstract to the concrete. Signed, a friend.
I first found Nico by staring at the sidewalks.
Delphine Vigil is a journalist from San Francisco.
One of my favorite things was always to kind of get lost in San Francisco and stare at things that I normally might have looked past. And then I saw his name written in the sidewalk.
Nico.
And I thought it was interesting. And then a block later, I found his name again.
Nico.
I turned a corner through Chinatown into North Beach, and I found another one. You know, I would find them not just in North Beach, but Chinatown, Russian Hill, Telegraph Hill. They would be references to the street name, like
Nico on Filbert, Nico on 9th,
or
Nico downtown.
And then the personality, I mean, was really coy. It was like,
Nico was here. Nico gets it all. Nico, concrete compulsive.
And I remember once I was just saying to myself, damn, Nico is everywhere. And then I looked down and it said,
Nico is everywhere.
I know, I felt like a duty, and I remember thinking that, this is my duty to write this story, and then coincidentally, I'd run across a clue that said,
Nico on duty.
So Delphine decided to track Nico down.
You know, I wanted to know, was this guy alive? Why did he do it? It was the first time I'd ever felt like I was the one paying attention in class.
The tag started in 1967.
Because I saw the date 1967, I figured, well, he must have been about, I don't know, 12 years old. In some ways, I got to watch him grow up because I felt like his personality kind of got a little more bolder through the years. Earlier stuff may just say
Nico.
And later on, he would call himself
Nico, concrete artist.
I figured he went to school in the neighborhood, so I went to the high school, Galileo, and I went to Francisco Middle School. And so I would start photocopying yearbook pictures from the 60s and 70s. And I would base this on guys who looked like they just had that kind of Artful Dodger look in their eye.
What you staring at?
And this investigation went on through years of dead ends, knocking on strangers' doors and getting nowhere. And if right now you're thinking, I love this Nico kid, he's my hero too, wait for it. Here it comes.
I was by the North Beach Playground. I believe it was rainy day, and rainy days were always the best days to read the concrete because it washed away a lot of the dirt and you could read things that on other days you probably couldn't see. And I saw this etching that was the longest that I'd ever seen. It took up an entire sidewalk block. It was like a paragraph. And at first I thought, no, it can't be him. I think it said,
America is a great country, built by the white man, owned by the Jews, ruined by the...
And then the first word began with an N, but I can't actually say for sure. I mean, I can presume what it said, and you probably can too. But that those letters were actually washed away from foot traffic. And then I'd found quite a few others, and it was, you know, we're talking 10, 15, 20.
Oh, man.
As far as I could tell from the handwriting, it was Nico. I didn't want to believe it because it didn't go with, you know, what I identified with. I mean, to some extent, I wanted to identify as the kind of loner kid in the city too. And this happened right before I finally found him.
One of the leads finally panned out, and after a long email courtship, Delphine Vigil grabbed his notebook and microcassette recorder and met Nico.
How did you never get caught?
Pretend like you're tying your shoes.
Pretend like you're tying your shoes.
It's the oldest trick in the book, or pretend like you dropped something.
How many do you think you've done?
1,000.
1,000, huh?
I'm just picking 1,000 out of the air.
At least 1,000.
At least 1,000, yeah.
Nico described all the places he tagged in detail, and Delphine believes that the vast majority of them are from this one guy.
My thoughts were that if I do this really deep and do it right, this stuff will last way into the future, and it'll be like the concrete will be all washed away with the pebbles poking up. My name will still be there.
It's kind of like any story you get into when you have a hunch about it. A lot of it was very close to what I had imagined, and a lot of it was completely different. He did have a very artful Dodger lifestyle. His father was out of the picture, and he had a very bohemian upbringing with kind of like a real carefree parenting style. He was just this kid who was sort of, in some ways, forgotten.
And after a few meetings, Delphine finally found the opportunity to ask the hard questions.
I would see a ban all non-white immigration over by the Stockton Tunnel, and then I'd see it over on Russian Hill. There's how about white race consciousness, keep America white. About 12 or 13 of them in the same block of cement, I'd also saw the name Nico. And
let's jump ahead. You probably want to know, did I write that stuff?
Well, I'll be straight up honest with you. I think you did. I can pick out about 15 to 20 that seem to me would be the same guy who did Nico, who would be you. But if I'm wrong...
Here's the deal, look. Okay. When I was a kid growing up in the city,
yeah,
I'm talking a little kid, on Sunday, we would go to a march in Oakland for civil rights, for a peace march. On Monday, I'd go to school, and I'd get the shit kicked out of me by the very people that we were out putatively trying to help. And this sounds absurd now, but it was all in my mind, it was all put together. If you get right down to it, how does a boring suburban kid rebel against their parents? They go to the opposite extreme of what the parents believe in, right? But I repent.
Totally, I understand.
I'm a hardcore green activist now, man.
Yeah.
Have some more cheese, man.
Thanks.
And that explanation would sit better if the past wasn't written in concrete.
I've not written my name, but I've written his name in wet concrete. In fact, that was the first line I wrote for the story. It was in the sidewalk. Walk up Montgomery Street toward the Union Street steps and make a right at Green Street, and right there, unless someone's double parked on top of it, it should still say, I found Nico.
I found Nico.
That piece was produced by Roman Mars for the podcast 99% Invisible. When it comes to vegetarianism, there are the raw fooders, the vegans, the lacto-vegetarians, and the often overlooked pescatarians, those who don't eat meat but make an exception for fish. While some pescatarians eat seafood for its health benefits, there are those who just don't feel the same level of empathy for the cold-blooded cod as they do for the lovable cow, which may be due to the fact that fish don't seem to exhibit the same kinds of fear and pain responses as other types of animals. Dan Nosowitz is a writer for Modern Farmer, and he wrote about a new study that complicates that point of view. Dan, great to have you back on Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
So what was this study looking to find out, and how'd they do it?
So the study was looking into a tendency known as emotional fever, which is kind of a controversial idea, but certainly related to the pain response, we think. Pain is kind of a much more complicated concept than people tend to think it is. So the idea behind emotional fever is that animals under stress tend to undergo an increase in body temperature, a few degrees maybe. It's well understood in mammals, rats, for example, humans as well, birds. It's pretty common when an animal is under stress, their internal body temperature kind of goes up a little bit. Where that gets complicated is measuring it in cold-blooded animals like reptiles or fish, because they're incapable of internally changing their own body temperature. Like a warm-blooded animal, like a mammal, can change our temperature. That's how we can stay warm or stay cool as necessary. Cold-blooded animal can't do that. That's why they have to, you know, go sit in the sun or go dunk into water to kind of change their internal temperature.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a tricky study, because how do you figure out if an animal has an emotional fever if they're like physiologically incapable of having an emotional fever?
Yeah. So how did they do it?
So they stressed out some fish. It's a zebrafish. And they kept them in aquariums with kind of hot spots in them,
mm-hmm.
with the idea that because the fish can't internally change their temperature, if they move to a warm area when stressed out, that's kind of their way of emulating this idea of emotional fever, that they try to warm themselves to a higher temperature. And what they found was that after some zebrafish were stressed out. They were kept in a net and kept at kind of an uncomfortable, colder temperature. After they were released, they moved to one of these hot spots. So they raised their body temperature. But they didn't just go back to their normal, comfortable temperature. They went 2 to 4 degrees more Celsius.
So what do they draw from that?
What I think it means is at least some indication that cold-blooded animals like these fish can exhibit this same kind of idea of emotional fever.
You have written about some other studies that look at how plants react to being eaten. What do we know about plants and pain, or our concept of pain?
Right. So this is really interesting because you end up in this kind of philosophical netherland between pain and reflex and survival tactics. Pain isn't this simple thing that you can just look at. You know, if this one type of electrical stimulus is transferred, then therefore that equals pain. It just isn't really that simple. It's this kind of blend of reflexes and reactions, and eventually, theoretically, they add up to pain. But, you know, we can't really ask a fish or a plant if it's in pain. So it can be kind of hard to tell. But a study not too long ago, this is a study from late 2014, looked into the way Arabidopsis, which is one of the most popular plants for experimentation. This plant, the Arabidopsis, is commonly eaten by caterpillars. And the noise that the caterpillar makes, these kind of vibrations from munching on the plant's leaves, it's a very specific vibration. And what these scientists found was that by emulating those specific vibrations, basically like putting a speaker next to the plant and playing caterpillar eating noises, essentially, they found that the plant produces kind of mildly toxic oils and sends them through the leaves to deter the predators, which is their kind of defense mechanism.
That's so crazy. But, you know, is it not true that any kind of distress, like a cold wind or something stepping on a plant, I mean, would it experience the same kind of result?
They didn't test for that. All they tested for was this specific kind of defense mechanism. But it's a really specific one. You know, if there was a change in temperature, this plant wouldn't send out these oils to their leaves because it wouldn't really have the effect that they want. Really what the study shows is just that plants are much more, I guess you could use the word intelligent, than previously assumed. You know, a plant isn't just kind of a dumb organism that just grows and is, you know, provided for us to eat. That it really is understanding its environment and reacting very quickly to stimuli in a way that I think a lot of people aren't aware of.
Well, the intelligence question is interesting because we know that octopuses, for example, they're very intelligent creatures, but that doesn't keep people from eating them. So is there any kind of equivalency between suffering and smarts?
That's kind of unclear. I mean, the idea of intelligence is really heavily based on human intelligence. We really only understand intelligence that's similar to our own. So when we do tests to figure out how intelligent another organism is, they're really more designed to figure out how much the organism thinks in the same way that we do, how mm-hmm. similar their thought process is to ours.
Right. We can't seem to help but anthropomorphize. You know, we have notions of fear and pain and panic, and
right.
we project them.
Yeah. And there are also just these other, like, we tend to do tests that are heavily based on vision because our vision is our most important sense. We kind of intake everything through our eyes. But that's not the most important sense for a lot of other organisms. And for an animal like, I don't know, a raccoon maybe, or a squirrel that is heavily reliant on touch, when we try to give them intelligence tests, it really doesn't tell us much except that they don't think the way that we do. Mm. They just use their intelligence in a different way.
So what do you think, Dan, is behind this whole area of study of understanding the pain that things that we consume go through?
I mean, this, you know, science can be wielded by anyone with any kind of agenda. So this would be a pretty easy, the fish one especially, would be a pretty easy study for, I don't know, like vegetarian activists, vegan activists to kind of grab onto, animal rights activists to kind of grab onto and say, look, you know, fish feel stress, therefore we shouldn't be eating them. But I don't know. I don't really look at it that way. I mostly just look at it as a new way to kind of understand how plants and animals, all organisms, think and act and react and behave in their environments. I just think it's interesting to learn about.
Do you think any of these studies could have a real influence on the number of people who are willing to make an exception for fish or other animals?
I don't know. I think there was a big study about lobsters from a few years ago that I think maybe had more of an effect, just because that was such a widely assumed thing that lobsters can't feel pain and therefore it's okay to toss them into a pot of boiling water while still alive. That was maybe a well-known enough topic that it might have changed the way people act. But I think the intelligent stuff probably won't have that much of an effect, really. I mean, like, we eat pigs, which are highly intelligent, very capable, very adaptable, and we still eat them. So I don't know how much effect it's going to have in that sense.
Well, Dan Nosowitz, thank you for speaking with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Dan Nosowitz, he's a writer with Modern Farmer, and you can find a link to read his article on the fish pain study at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Think back to the first time you learned about gravity. You likely heard the story about the young man named Isaac Newton sitting under a tree in a garden, contemplating the world around him, when an apple suddenly bonked him on the head. And in a moment of brilliance, he discovered the law of universal gravitation. Well, as much as we may want to believe in those solitary genius eureka moments, Ronald Numbers argues that they are little more than fables. But where do these stories come from, and why do they persist? Ronald delves into these questions in Newton's Apple and Other Myths About Science. It's a book of essays that he co-edited with Kostas Kamparakis. Ronald Numbers, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you very much.
So is any part of that Newton and the Apple story true?
That's very difficult to say. It would be easier to say that not much of it is true, if any of it is true.
Well, where'd it come from? It
started circulating while he was still alive, and it may have had some influence watching things fall, but as you pointed out in your introduction, these type of eureka moments rarely occur. And this one almost certainly didn't.
So why did the myth persist then? Is the truth just too complicated or maybe even too boring for the general public?
I think both of those. I don't know that you've ever tried to read the Principia, virtually unreadable book, highly mathematical. Very few of his contemporaries read it, but it was immensely influential among specialists. He later wrote a book on optics, which was very accessible, and a lot of people in the 18th century developed their ideas about Newton from reading the optics rather than the mathematical principles of natural philosophy.
Well, Newton has inspired other myths, one that his discoveries made God superfluous or irrelevant, but he was actually quite religious.
He was quite religious, not particularly orthodox, but he spent a great deal of time studying the biblical prophecies, for example. He did actually invoke God, especially in the second edition of the Principia. He added a scholium, which talks about the relationship between natural philosophy and God. And he used God's intervention in order to avoid the collapse of the solar system.
So we have this idea, you know, that story with the apple casts Newton as this solitary genius, and we do refer to it as Newton's law of universal gravitation. How much collaboration, how much help did he get in developing this theory?
Well, he was well connected with his contemporaries. He was part of a network. He was connected with the Royal Society, and had correspondence with many people.
So why do we love that solitary genius? I mean, the essays also dispel myths about Darwin and Mendel and Higgs being, you know, sort of solitary geniuses. Why do we love these stories? Are we looking for a protagonist?
We tend to have a need for, and certainly a desire for, heroes. And in this way, we're able to provide some. And we even do it today when very few discoveries would involve a single person. You have entire teams, maybe dozens of people co-authoring a piece, and sometimes the person credited with the, quote, discovery is the one who got the grant, but maybe didn't do much of the experimental or theoretical work at all. So it's very difficult for historians of science adequately to assign credit.
Well, sometimes we see a group of three winning the Nobel Prize, for example, but it's often just one person.
Yes, yes. That's the way it happens. But can you imagine trying to remember 25 names for each discovery?
Well, like Newton and the apple, another story that we are told as kids is that Columbus, Christopher Columbus, was the first person to publicly assert that the Earth was round. And everybody thought he was crazy as he bravely set off across the sea. Is this true? And where did that story come from?
Well, it seems to have come from a biography in the early 19th century by Washington Irving, an American author, who, to enhance the excitement of the story, said that the sailors and Columbus were afraid of going over the edge of a flat earth, but he proved them all wrong. And then some scholars in the middle of the 19th century began arguing that during the Middle Ages, the church had pronounced that the earth was flat based on some biblical passages. It's an easy notion to refute historically. Every scholar from Aristotle's time onward knew that the earth was a sphere. That was not in play. There were a couple of people in the Eastern Orthodox tradition who seemed to have defended a flat earth, and presumably they had some followers that went along with them. But there, as far as I know, there are probably two extant passages, both of them out of the Eastern Orthodox tradition, defending a flat earth based on biblical passages.
So did that apple fall on Newton's head? Did Columbus's sailors think they were going to sail over the edge of the earth? Those are just a couple of myths being demystified in a new collection of essays called Newton's Apples and Other Myths About Science. And my guest is Ronald Numbers, a co-editor of that book. Well, are these myths, the myth of Columbus and Sir Isaac Newton, are they still in textbooks?
Oh, you bet they are.
Well, it makes me wonder about how the scientific discoveries of today are going to be cast in the future.
Well, it does, doesn't it? And the process of science and scientific discovery has gotten ever more complex, so it's going to be more difficult to portray science. It's very difficult to write about or even teach the history of 20th century and 21st century science. Often you spend more of your time trying to explain the theories than talking about the history of the theories.
Well, any myths throughout history that you found particularly troubling or maybe absurd?
Well, one that I think really gets in our way and that is widely circulated down to the present is the myth that Galileo was tortured and persecuted for teaching that the earth goes around the sun.
He was never tortured, never beaten, never imprisoned?
Never. He was put on trial, but when he was summoned to Rome, he spent the first part of his period there in the Tuscan palace, where he was treated as a celebrity. Even when he was called to the Inquisition for the trial, one of the officers of the Inquisition gave up what I recall, was a six-room apartment so that Galileo and his servant could be housed in luxury. And he didn't have to eat the Inquisition food because the chef at the Tuscan embassy catered his meals. Historians who are specialists in this have pieced together almost hour by hour accounts of his time there, and he almost certainly never was tortured.
Wow.
Psychologically, he may have been apprehensive. He certainly wasn't fearful for his life. And one of the reasons why he was treated well, not only was he an aged guy and there were rules governing what you could do, but before the trial, he had become a Catholic cleric. So he was sentenced to house arrest on his way back to Florence. He was the honored guest of the Bishop of Siena for some time, and then he went back up to his villa out in the outskirts of Florence. It wasn't the most wonderful thing in the world, probably, but it wasn't the worst thing that could happen to you.
Well, science and religion, that friction emerge over and over and again in these essays. Now, why is that combination so ripe for myth-making?
Because too many people are trying to score points rather than to understand the past as it happened, or to the extent that we can establish how things happened. A related one to Galileo that still appears in many textbooks is that the Copernican Revolution, which Galileo was promoting, found resistance because it demoted humans from the center of the universe. And that's historically silly because, according to the Aristotelian Ptolemaic worldview that was being overthrown, the center of the cosmos was the lowliest, worst place, kind of the garbage pit of the universe. It was not a wonderful place. It wasn't until Newtonian physics replaced Aristotelian physics that this idea disappeared. So no contemporaries of Copernicus or Galileo would have said, oh my, you know, this is demoting us. But that still appears routinely in textbooks.
So what does it take to reveal the falsity of these myths? Is it just time? Is it just that, you know, pseudoscience is taken over by real science or the science of the day?
Well, this is based on historical records, so good science probably won't change anything. The history of science and religion in the past 40 years or so has been written largely by people without an axe to grind. So that should help. The problem from our perspective is that it's hard to reach the public. And some of the stories that we're trying to correct are so wonderful and so closely held that it's a difficult task.
Professor Numbers, thank you so much for busting some myths from the world of science.
Happy to do so.
Ronald Numbers, he's an historian of science and medicine and professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He co-edited a new book of essays called Newton's Apple and Other Myths About Science. And you can find more in the book on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Whether on the playground or at home, most young children love to play pretend with dolls or stuffed animals and each other. Some children, about 65%, go one step further into the pretend world and take on an imaginary friend. And those imaginary pals, rather than being a cause for concern, could be giving kids an assist in the real world, at least according to current research in developmental psychology. Pin Huang brings us the story.
Let me throw a concept at you. Theory of mind. It's one of the most important milestones in early childhood development, studied by psychologists and neuroscientists around the world. It's a very basic understanding that other people have thoughts and feelings that are different from your own. The phrase was coined by University of Pennsylvania researchers in 1978, who wrote a paper asking if the chimpanzee has theory of mind. The jury's still out on that one, but in humans, it usually develops between 3 and 5 years old.
And we call it a theory because there's nothing about the other person that shows that they're thinking. Thoughts are hidden. We don't see them. The only way we can imagine that thoughts are there and that they cause behavior is if we have a theory about the way the world works.
That's Robert Seyferth, a psychologist at University of Pennsylvania, in a video for the Richard Dawkins Foundation for Reason and Science. And theory of mind? Researchers have found that it's critical to successful social interactions, reading body language, getting sarcasm, empathy, perspective taking. They've also found that some unlikely characters might help young kids develop theory of mind and the skills that go with it. Who are those characters? It's kids' imaginary friends. So let me tell you a story about an imaginary friend named Georgie.
Georgie!
I'll let Casey, who's 4 years old, describe him for you.
My grandson has long knees, and he has a skeleton inside.
That's right. Georgie is Casey's imaginary grandson, and he's been his constant companion for years. He showed up when Casey was about 2. Lots of kids have imaginary friends, but why the grandson?
I mean, maybe it's just, you know, we're older as parents, and so most of his relatives are older. He's surrounded by old people. So maybe that's why he has a grandson to, like, fit in. I have no idea.
Sarah Rodrigo is Casey's mom, and over the years, she's learned a lot about Georgie. He's a man with a head, shoulders, belly, and shoes. He lives out in California, has big muscles, drives monster trucks, and knows a lot about the world.
We are terrible parents because we haven't taught him anything. As soon as we tell him anything, he tells us that Georgie told him that. So, yeah, he's comprehensive. His knowledge is encyclopedic. He's everywhere and nowhere. It's really amazing.
Casey's parents and teachers have played along with it. They ask questions about Georgie's hair, where he lives, what he does. But for decades, Georgie and his type were considered trouble. In psychology, from the late 1800s on, all sorts of problems were connected with imaginary friends. Early researchers thought kids who created them were moody and explosive. They were socially isolated and had adjustment difficulties. It was the heyday of Freudian psychology. And according to Professor Tracy Gleason, developmental psychologist at Wellesley College, it gave imaginary friends a bad rap.
The psychoanalysts got a hold of it, and so in their case studies, they describe these imaginary companions, and they talk about them in very psychoanalytic terms, you know. What does this mean, and should we worry, and what does this tell us about what's going on with this child in a kind of atmosphere of concern?
By the mid-20th century, that research had gotten into parenting culture through experts like Dr. Benjamin Spock. He was well-established as the authority on parenting by the time he was introduced in 1966 on the Merv Griffin Show.
As it is well known, George Washington is the father of our country. But there is a man here who comes in a close second. The top-selling book in the world is the Bible. The second bestseller belongs to Dr. Spock, his books on child care. And he is here today. Would you welcome Dr. Benjamin Spock?
Dr. Spock taught that kids like Casey needed help. He advised parents like Sarah to give more hugs and to maybe call a psychologist. But it turns out, a lot of those fears were based on flawed research. The kids in the studies already had issues. Some of them came from psychiatric wards. Professor Tracy Gleason is part of a wave of scientists that have studied imaginary friends in the typical population since the 1990s.
You get all kinds. I once met a multicolored herd of cows. They were very sweet.
She and psychologists like her now think it's totally normal, even advantageous, for toddlers and kids to have imaginary friends. Remember that theory of mind? Professor Gleason says Casey spends a lot of time thinking about what imaginary Georgie might say or do, basically practicing his theory of mind skills. And in fact, it might help that Georgie's not real. An imaginary friend is around whenever you need him. And all that time with Georgie is helping Casey learn things that might help him in the real world. As Professor Gleason told me,
if you look at the literature, There's some suggestion that these kids are more sociable than other kids. There's some suggestion that they might be a little bit ahead of their peers in their thinking about other people, in their understanding that other people have thoughts that are different than their own. They might be a little ahead in terms of empathy and perspective taking, those kinds of skills.
Casey's mom has seen this in action.
He's really good at making friends and blending into a group and just being a really social kid and getting along with other kids. And so it doesn't seem to have a negative effect at all at this point, you know? It's the opposite.
It also turns out that Casey has a lot of company. Research from Yale shows that up to 65% of kids have imaginary friends by the age of 7. Studies from Columbia and Yale have also shed light on the predictors of imaginary friends. Casey checks many of those boxes. He's an only child. His parents limit his television and screen time. And the adults around him encourage the imagining. It all marks a big shift in the way researchers think about kids with imaginary friends, no longer the strange, maladaptive children described half a century ago. You might be wondering, what's going to happen to Georgie? It's sad but true. He'll disappear someday. If you've seen the movie Inside Out, you know that heartbreaking moment where the imaginary friend disappears into the abyss of forgotten memories. Professor Gleason says it's totally natural. It's like outgrowing a set of blocks or a stuffed animal. But just because Casey's imaginary friend will fade away doesn't mean that his imagination will go with it. Researchers are just starting to draw the links between imaginary friends in childhood and creativity and storytelling throughout our lives.
You know, for a long time it was, you do this when you're 3, 4, 5, but then after that, you know, that's then it's pathology. And in fact, I think that's not true. I think we do a lot more of this social imagination kind of stuff, like these internal conversations or imagining ourselves in relationships with media figures and celebrities. There's lots of ways that we use imagination in social ways, and imaginary companions are just one of them.
So Georgie could return one day as the mother of invention. Studies do show that fiction writers are more likely to have had imaginary friends, and that actors are especially good at theory of mind. Who knows? Maybe one day, a few decades from now, he'll be sitting down to read a book by Casey or watching him on the big screen. Of course, we can't really know for sure. He's only 4. And there's really no point in speculating. One of the cool things about a runaway imagination is this. You can't control where it takes you.
They went in my grandson started up in his engine, and he ran fast, and he did a flippy slip. He did a double backflip.
Oh my God.
I'm Ping Huang.
And that story came to us as part of the STEM Story Project, distributed by PRX and made possible with funds from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation. Well, we are so grateful for your listening time today, and there is, as always, much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org and at our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. And in both places, you'll find a slight chink in the holiday cheer we're all encouraged to exhibit this time of year. That's right, things are getting fierce in Word of Mouth's first annual holiday song bracket. And we could not have predicted this one, folks. Barbara Streisand's Silent Night, History. Both versions of Sleigh Ride by the Carpenters and Sufjan Stevens dragged out of the ring. We're now in the penultimate round of voting, so take a moment now to weigh in on the face-off between Nat King Cole's O Holy Night, which is toe-to-toe with Bing Crosby's White Christmas.
I'm dreaming of a Christmas.
Then we've also got She and Him's version of Baby It's Cold Outside, taking on Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas by Sam Smith.
Have yourself a merry little Christmas. Let your heart be light.
We're going to leave the vote open over the weekend and announce the winner on Monday. So cast your vote now in NHPR's first annual holiday song face-off. I'm Virginia Prescott, keeping my vote a secret, and I'll be back tomorrow at 2 with more word of mouth from NHPR.
Have yourself a merry little Christmas. Make the Yuletide gay.